Good. So I was joking with my wife when I was thinking about this yesterday of how to say that, you know, there's a fine line between a sociopath and normalcy at times. And but in this story, it kind of makes that a little bit true for me, that there are times in our lives where we are kind of on a borderline between, based upon what events happen, about where the rest of our lives go. And this story is kind of that hinge point, if you will, for me and for my family. So, but first, I got to give you a little bit of background. I grew up in northern Maine, in Houlton. If you follow I-95 up to where it goes into Canada, that's my hometown. And one of the big things about it is winter is 9 months of snow, right? So we joke about it, say, it's 9 months of winter and 3 months of crappy snowmobiling. And you spend those 3 months of summer typically getting ready for winter. It's a big thing up there. And it's also 95% forest. So wood is the primary fuel source for a lot of people up there. And, you know, we don't have like natural gas piped to the ground. People live too far apart and stuff like that. So there's a lot of, when you think of Maine, you probably should think of people subsisting off of the land and highly independent. And poverty actually is one of the poorest states in the nation too. I think a lot by choice though. But in my situation, it wasn't just about that. It wasn't choice. I come from a family of where divorce dictated a lot of what happened. And so this story actually occurs after my mother ended up. She was married to this man who had two kids. Actually, my sister Mandy was not quite born yet when her husband left her. November in Maine, with a big pile of logs on the lawn, literally, and just up and left her. And she doesn't have a job, no means of income, and how are we going to make do? There was two of us, my brother and I, and my sister Melissa, and another man, Mandy, was on the way, due in April. So this would have put my mother about 4 or 5 months pregnant. So this is the situation. Obviously, I guess if you put it in the context, the first thing we need is, okay, how are we going to make it through the winter? There's a pile of logs out there on the lawn. Literally, I mean, you'd have to picture it. All these logs were probably about as long as the back of the church, and it was probably, you know, about the height, twice the height of a 10-year-old, because I was about 10 at the time. And, of course, it was a very traumatic situation. And the reason I say I was on the board, you know, is that one of those hinge moments is I was really glad to see my stepfather leave. But at the same point, really kind of torn and angry about the situation, obviously. So we often talk about how we choose churches based upon our doctrine, and we look for churches that say the right things. In suburban St. Louis, that might be how you pick a church. That's not how you pick churches in the place I grew up in. You pick churches based upon the church that actually is the hands and feet of Christ to the people around them, because people are so close to problems and to desperation that it's the church that often helps keep people out of really, really bad situations. And one of the churches in my hometown that was really good at doing that at that time, and to my knowledge still is a Wesleyan church just the Houlton Wesleyan Church. And what happened was all of a sudden they found out about our situation. And this is, like I said, early November or mid-November. And we have all this wood out there. All of a sudden, one day, 20 men from the church showed up with chainsaws. And they cut it all up. I mean, in a day or maybe two, they cut up all that wood. And somebody brought a splitter. And they split all the wood, and they stacked it all in our basement. We put it all down there. And one of the most amazing parts of it is they didn't just do the job, but me, the 10-year-old, the man of the house, I was the oldest son, they included me in it. So part of the story might be a little emotional. So here's a 10-year-old. Obviously, I couldn't use the chainsaw. To this day, I still want to use the chainsaw, right? Diane doesn't want me to get a chainsaw because she's afraid what I'll cut down, I think. But they included me in that. And that was a real important thing, because my stepfather was such a poor example of manhood and fatherhood that I needed somebody to show me that it wasn't just about stacking wood. But so that day, 8 cords of wood, and if you have any idea how much wood that is, that's a lot of wood to cut and stack. And I do believe they actually came back with more the following week, because it takes about 8 to 10 cords of wood if you're primarily burning wood to get through a Maine winter. It's a really cold winter. And they checked on things to make sure that it could be done. They even, to some extent, taught me how I needed to split kindling, how to start a fire, because I was the man of the house that was going to be doing a lot of this. To some extent, I didn't know that. My stepfather never actually bothered to teach those kinds of things, so I just didn't know. But they didn't stop there. They brought turkey, Thanksgiving dinner. It was all taken care of. The amazing thing is, we went from purely destitute. I mean, literally destitute. I don't know what we would have done. My mother didn't know. I mean, even though government assistance is there, but you know what? Government assistance actually takes a couple months to actually start happening. And you have to go and say, here's my situation, and you have to plead before somebody in government and basically lay your life bare and beg, and then they give you something in a couple months because they don't know a sense of urgency. The Wesleyan Church knew that sense of urgency. And they were there. There was somebody out there like every week and to several days were out there. Just making sure that things were taken care of. And then it just started the cascade. It wasn't just the people and it wasn't just that church. That Christmas. It was the most amazing Christmas ever, and we had nothing. We garlanded the tree with popcorn, right? We made stained glass window cookies. You ever make those? You basically cut a little hole in a sugar cookie, and then you put a lifesaver in it. And so we had nothing, and yet we had everything. I can't tell this story without crying about it, because it was the most beautiful example of hands and feet of Christ. And I know I can't do it very well. What it showed me was, it showed me that there was a way to make a difference, and that people could do it, even if their theology wasn't perfect. Even if, you know, they might do things differently than I would. But they cared. They put hands and feet on the gospel. And they showed up. There's 16 churches in my hometown, and two showed up. Two. The Wesleyan Church and some of the folks from the Court Street Baptist, because that's where a lot of my family went as well. And the family came around. Of course, I come from a big family, and they showed up, and the neighbors showed up. They brought gifts. I don't know how many gifts we actually had on that Christmas day. Because, of course, my mother was like, well, where am I going to buy gifts for the children? We hadn't bought them. But there was all kinds of cool stuff that was underneath that tree. I don't know where most of it came from. But people kept showing up with bags of gifts. And they took care of us. I was at the point where I hated everything because of my stepfather, because of what he did. And that outpouring of love changed everything. It didn't just warm us for the winter, so we had wood. It didn't just feed us a turkey dinner so we could be thankful at Thanksgiving. It didn't just, you know, give us Christmas gifts so on Christmas Day we could wake up and open things. It showed us people's hearts.
to show us a gospel that could actually go beyond just the physical things that we did. And when I think of the brokenness that was in our home at that point, that was when the healing began. The healing began because all of a sudden this cancer that was my stepfather was out of the house, and the brokenness needed healing, and it could either heal in gentleness and in love and in mercy, or it can heal in bitterness and spite and anger. And because of those people that came and showed up and did what they did and included me in on it, included my brother in on it, and put their arms around my mother, it healed in love and gentleness and grace. And that's what we're called to be, right? The reason I brought my Bible up was just to say the one thing that James says in here. We talked about, we referred to James 19, but before that, it says, "What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him?" The answer is no. "If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, be warmed and be filled,' without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, it's dead." So I find it really hard here in St. Louis to see such destitution in certain places and say, "Well, I shouldn't give money to that, or I shouldn't hand it out." And I know half of them are trying to rip you off on the sides of the streets or whatnot. But I remember that time. I remember that it's not about the money. It's about the heart behind it. It's about how do you serve and show mercy? Because if you don't show mercy, how is this person going to know mercy? You might be the only one that actually reaches out and shows them mercy in that time of their ultimate need. Remember, I said there was 16 churches in town and 2 showed up. And the one church that didn't show up was the church that we attended with my stepfather. Because the deacon of that church was a brother-in-law. At that moment, right, there's a choice. And that choice is whether you will be one of the ones that James says has active faith or not. And I don't really have a whole lot of use for the churches and the people that don't show the active faith. Because I don't think Jesus does either. Because had those 2 churches not shown up, I could have just been the sociopath, right? I mean, literally, I was always on the edge of bitterness and anger. And self-immolation, if you will. So what they did is they came out, and they didn't stop there. So all of a sudden, so we started attending. Because remember what I said is, people don't choose the church there because they have the exact right doctrine. And the sad part is Northern New England is pretty much a hotbed of moralism and legalism, but there are some people out there making a difference. And they gather together in these churches and they bring people to them. The most active and vibrant church in my hometown is still the Wesleyan Church. Why? Only because they reach out into the community and they do things. And everyone in the community knows that church. Everyone in the community knows what they do. Everyone in the community goes there occasionally, at least for some activity or event and mercy. Even though sometimes they get it wrong. But they always reach out. So we started attending that church, and they just kept taking care of us. They checked up on us. You know, all of a sudden, we got assistance from the government, and the government is not good at the development part, rehabilitation here at all. It took a long time for my mother to actually find a way out of the hole that welfare just puts you in. But the church helped, and the people came around us, and we attended there for years. And I was first baptized, if I remember correctly, in a Wesleyan church.
Now, the Baptist didn't think that was good enough and baptized me again, but that's a different story. But I attended there for some time, and I started going to the youth group, and we had these youth rallies in Canada, because Wesleyan Church is real much bigger in the Maritime provinces. And so they helped us out quite a lot, and they always made sure if I wanted to go to the youth rally that I didn't have to pay for it. But that's not my family's way of things, and you know we want to do it ourselves. So when I was 13, there was another youth rally coming up in Moncton, and so I started looking around. I'm old enough at this point. I've got all kinds of spare jobs, and I'm trying to earn money that way, and because I didn't want hand-me-downs, so I used the money to buy my own clothes too, right? Because the hand-me-downs were all... Remember in the early 80s, all the 70s hand-me-downs were those, like, plaid pants and stuff? Oh. I mean, I know they clothed you, but they really weren't cool at all. And 13, you know, cool starts to become important. But I needed $60 or $90, whatever it was, for the youth rally. And I started asking around folks around the church, hey, you got any spare jobs? I want to earn money to go to the youth rally. Well, the pastor heard about it, and... So I guess he thought he was helping me out, but he gets up in church on Sunday morning, and he says, "We need your help, Ken Mack. If you'd like to go to the youth rally, so if you want to donate to help him get there, just let me know." That was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life, because all I needed was somebody to help me. Hey, just give me a job, pay me, and I'll go, because. To some extent, you know, it does become unhelpful. We were out of the relief. The immediate need was taken care of, and we get on to development. It's not done something that's done to you; it's done for you or with you, right? I never went back on a regular basis to that church ever again after that day because I was so embarrassed. 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds get embarrassed real easy in some of these things, right? And, yeah, I didn't show my face there again, so we ended up going back to the church that my family had gone to, Court Street Baptist. My mother goes to the Wesleyan Church even today. She went back afterwards. But that was just an example of, okay, that probably wasn't the right thing to do. But they still do amazing work, even though, you know, they get it wrong sometimes. They still reach out to the community. My cousins go there as well, and we have theological discussions that are a lot more reformed, maybe, than Wesleyan, but they go there because they can be hands and feet, because there's a lot of churches there that they're so ingrown, so focused on themselves, that they don't know that there's a community out there that's in dire need and desperate need, not just of their things and their money, but of the gospel that they know. And the gospel isn't ingrown at all. It's important for us to remember that. That the gospel can't be inward focused. If it is, it's not the gospel. The gospel must be outward focused. It must be shared. Because the gospel flowing through you is how it empowers you. The gospel's not for you, it's to give away and through you. So that's all I got to say. Thanks.
Ken, thank you so much.